Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Rebecca Larson. Today, I am joined by Stephen Verapin to talk about Anne of Denmark and her relationship with James I. But let me tell you, we go so much deeper than that, so you'll have to tune in to find out more. I hope you enjoy.
The Tudors Dynasty Podcast.
Stephen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I am really excited to have you on the show because I think you first introduced yourself to me way back in maybe 2018 when you started.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
it flies.
It really does. Here we are. It's 2024. And this is my first time interviewing you. You've been on the show before with Steph probably a couple years ago, maybe talking about James and Elizabeth, I think it was.
Yes.
Yes. And at that time, you were answering listener questions. And today I've invited you back to talk with me a little bit about, let's say, Anne of Denmark and James I. So before I get into the questions, why don't you give the audience a little idea of what your background is and why you're the perfect guest for this topic?
Sure. Well, I have been studying and writing about the Tudor and Stuart periods now for longer than I care to think about, actually, for a long time. My PhD was in Elizabethan slander and sedition, which kind of looked at the legal system in the period. It looked at the ecclesiastical system in the period. And it, as we know, it's very difficult to just separate things into reigns. At the end of Elizabeth's life, it wasn't the case that everything changed in the legal system and so on. So you end up looking into the sort of later period, look at what comes after. And I got very excited because I thought, God, things were just as exciting after the Tudors as they were during the Tudors' reign. So that's what led me into studying and writing about James and Queen Anne as well.
I'm glad that I have you on the show because my knowledge really stops at the Tudors. I know very little when it comes to the Stuarts. And so I would love to learn a lot about James and Anne today from you. Maybe we could start out with what made Anne of Denmark such a great match as a queen for James?
Well, that's an interesting question, Rebecca, because it comes down really to the economy. Yeah, I was going to say that sounds really harsh, but it comes down to economics. James, in the 1580s, after his mother was executed, really felt himself secure for the first time, or at least more secure. The reason for that was when Mary, Queen of Scots, had been alive, she was always claiming still to be Scotland's monarch. James, therefore, kind of lived in the shadow somewhat. He was trying to assert himself as King of Scots, but that was difficult when there was a still living Queen of Scots claiming that her abdication had been forced and so on. So after her execution, which James didn't want his mother to be executed, but it did, from a purely mercenary perspective, allow him to be sole king. And a sole king needed a wife, needed a queen, and needed to produce heirs. And there were really two paths open to him. He could have made a French match, which was an option, Catherine of Navarre, or he could have chosen a daughter of Denmark. And he supposedly wavered over this. He had portraits of the women. And he decided eventually, because there were riots in Edinburgh in favour of the Danish match, because it would open up trade, that he would plump for a Danish bride. But there was so much negotiation, things dragged on for so long, that his initial choice, Elizabeth of Denmark, ended up being promised elsewhere. So he had to settle for the second daughter of Denmark, and that was Anne or Anna.
Wow. Maybe it's just because I followed the Tudors for so long, but Denmark seems like such an odd choice. Usually you hear, England, Scotland, France, the Holy
Yes.
Roman Empire, anywhere but Denmark as a choice.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Scotland and Denmark did have a history together, not just economic, actually, but in terms of royal marriages. There had been a Danish queen before. There had been royal Scoto-Danish intermarriages before. But one of the reasons I think it became particularly important was religious. James's match, whoever she was, had to be Protestant because he was Protestant, and of course that was an important factor. The danger of the French match, he could have married Catherine of Navarre, as I said, but she was older apparently, and there was a very mean report written about her by an ambassador who went over to study her, and he said she was old, cracked, and something worse if all were known. Unfortunately, we don't know what that something worse was, but she was ruled out. But the real danger of that match was France was undergoing its periodic religious wars, and Scots were worried if we import a French queen or a queen with French royal connections, Scotland will be dragged into these religious wars. Whereas Denmark was also Protestant, although it was Lutheran rather than Calvinist. So James could marry a Danish princess and still maintain the kind of Protestant settlement, I suppose. Although there are questions about Anna's commitment to Protestantism, which we might touch on later.
Yes, we most definitely need to touch on that. I am curious too, now that you brought up Mary, Queen of Scots, did Anne of Denmark, was she aware of who James's mother was? Do we have any idea of what she knew?
She absolutely had to have been aware because it was her father who had arrested and locked up Bothwell. So
Right.
Mary's infamous husband, Bothwell. So she must have known, but she left no comment on it, as far as we know.
I would just think it'd be such a big shadow to live under when you
Yes.
come
Well,
in.
they'd have had something to talk about in bed,
That's
I suppose. Remember the time your father locked up my horrible stepfather and drove him insane.
Oh my gosh, that's too funny. Okay, so Anne was chosen, and how long did it take from the time that she was chosen as a bride to their marriage?
That is a very good question. Because in terms of the proxy marriage, that was fine. The things they used to do, well, the contract would be signed and someone would put a foot in the bed to represent the marriage and everything. And James was very keen on having her come to Scotland immediately. James was an interesting figure in terms of his sexuality, as I know the new TV show explores at fairly graphic fairly graphic depth. But he had only, as far as we know, had male lovers in his kind of teenage years, early 20s. And what he seems to have done is almost cleared out his bedchamber of these handsome boyfriends to make room for a queen. So he was what we would now call bisexual, even if that term didn't exist at the time. And he seems to have been quite keen on getting this bride into his country, into his bed to produce heirs and all of this sort of thing. But there were delays. Anna set out for Scotland from Denmark, and her ship was almost wrecked and it was cast onto the shores of Norway. Now, Norway was part of Danish territory at the time. Then she set out again and these storms rose again. And then I believe she set out a third time and storms rose again. And James was getting very impatient. He apparently went out and ordered fasting in Scotland, ordered prayers to try and calm the storms. He was really desperate to meet his bride. And these strange storms really over months prevented her from reaching Scotland. James eventually decided to go out and fetch her himself. So despite the storms and despite his, I think, unfair reputation for cowardice, which has gone down the centuries, has echoed down the centuries, and I'm always trying to tell people he wasn't this sort of cowardly, sniveling man at all. He could be very brave, could lead forces, he could sail out into storms. And that's what he did. He sailed out to fetch Anna, and then they met in Norway. They travelled from Norway to Denmark, and James had probably one of the happiest times in his life, actually, when he took his Scandinavian progress, a lot of drinking, a lot of educational pursuits. He really enjoyed himself. And one of the things that he experienced in Scandinavia, which I think made a real impression, was a sense of family life amongst the Danish royal family. James had never really known close family at all. He'd been brought up to fear his mother, to despise his mother, to think she'd murdered his father. All of this nonsense that was poured into his head by Protestant teachers. And he seems to have developed a real fascination with the idea of family and a real love for it. He was constantly trying to recreate a sense of family himself.
Well, who could blame him? Honestly, like you said, what a turbulent childhood that he had, just looking for some stability.
But yes, absolutely.
I do wonder, too, you know, with the delays of weather that came with her coming to Scotland, was there a lot of talk at court about it being a bad omen?
Not at first. And in Denmark, there was a bit of a blame game going on as to, had the ships been badly equipped? Had the ships been ill-fitted and things like this? And the Danish admiral decided, oh, I might get blamed for this. It can't possibly be my ill-equipment of the ships. It must have been something else that was behind these storms. And curiously enough, some absolutely, totally innocent women had been arrested on unrelated witchcraft charges at the time. What appears to have happened is that one of these women was tortured into admitting not only that her witchcraft had raised the storms, but that she had worked with others to do so. So when James got back to Scotland, this news came in, swept across the North Sea, I suppose, and he seems to have decided that the Danish witches could not have acted alone. There must have been Scottish witches as well. And this led to, I think, one of the real dark marks against James's name, which is, of course, his attitude to witchcraft and his belief in it. And this is often presented, I think, as a kind of backward thing. I mean, we know that he was an educated man. We know that he was an intelligent man. So people, I think, tend to think, well, how could he have believed this nonsense, this silliness about witches raising storms? But I think that's almost kind of missing the point of the period in its views on witchcraft. At the time, it was actually forward thinking to believe that witchcraft was real and it was created via demonic pacts and all of this stuff we now think of as ridiculous, crazy and backwards. It was actually forward-looking at the time. So James was on the kind of cutting edge from his perspective of continental thinking about good and evil, about witchcraft. And he absorbed all these lessons. He tried to drive witch hunts. He did that a couple of times. He believed this stuff. And I think it's very telling that his real goal in uncovering witchcraft in Scotland seems to have been with finding treasonous witchcraft. If we look at it as, I suppose it would be like the equivalent of a modern day government finding a terrorist cell or something, or believing it's found a terrorist cell. Witchcraft was as real as using gunpowder to attack the king or using any other physical weapon. So he really did believe this. He believed there were covens, we'd now call them, of witches who were sort of using these demonic powers to attack him treasonably.
It seems kind of, I don't want to use the word crazy, but it seems a little crazy now that he believed in that as much as he did, when he also, because of what happened with the storms, was able to see that great royal family dynamic.
Yes, I suppose we have to look at what was being taught at the time in terms of causation, in terms of witchcraft, in terms of the supernatural. And what we find quite a lot as well, there were a lot of people writing about witchcraft and a lot of people promoting it. So it would, people that denied it would have looked to James and his contemporaries, like modern day people who believe in flat earth and things like that. We can look at them and think, that's crazy. How can you believe that? James and his learned friends would have looked at people that denied witchcraft and thought, oh, they're crazy denialists. Absolute nonsense. They would have been the ones that were the minority that looked kind of backwards and behind the times.
Yeah. Okay. So I love the witchcraft topic. Maybe we'll get back to that a little bit more, but I want to get back.
As a result, he wrote the book. I mean, he wrote Demonology following that first witchcraft trial. And this, he really set out his stall as to why there is real witchcraft and there is counterfeit witchcraft. And the real stuff is the dangerous stuff. And the real stuff is led by the devil who makes these pacts with certain people. And he even offered a reason as to why it was mostly women. And that would be the case. It would be 85% of people prosecuted for witchcraft in Scotland would be women. James, of course, gave the conventionally misogynistic view. It's because women were the weaker vessel. It's because women were more easily tempted, you know, all of this stuff. I think the real reason probably was that women were treated as second-class citizens, so it was much easier to believe evil of women. It was much easier to target women and victimize them.
You know, Elizabeth Woodville was, I want to say, accused of witchcraft or rumors of witchcraft with her. But did that ever happen with Anne?
No, but it did happen. Well, not that I've come across, but it did happen with Mary, Queen of Scots. Mary was accused of witchcraft by James's tutor. Now, it was in a kind of offhand way. It was a very political accusation. He called her, what was it, a poisoning witch and bloody murderous woman. Darnley was accused of witchcraft as well, James's father. He had supposedly used bracelets to enchant Mary, Queen of Scots. So Scotland had a rich tradition, as did England, of using witchcraft as a kind of political accusation. Accuse your political enemy of witchcraft. And that's what happened as soon as James and Anna returned to Scotland. There were the sort of lower level witches in this imaginary coven, but the names, as they kind of spread and accusations flew everywhere, as tends to happen in witch hunts, they landed on Bothwell. That wasn't Mary, Queen of Scots, Bothwell, but his nephew, Francis Hepburn, Earl of Bothwell, who found himself being accused of being the kind of witch ringleader.
I love witchcraft stories. You know, you mentioned Darnley and the bracelets, and my mind immediately went to, well, if it's only women or primarily women who are witches, maybe it was Darnley's mother who gave him the
Oh. She
bracelets.
was accused as well. Yeah, she was caught up in that. From her position in England, she had supposedly sent these enchanted bracelets north.
I love all of these connections. It's just
Yeah.
brilliant.
It's one of the good things I think about particularly noble and royal families. I mean, they were also almost incestuous and related to one
Yes.
another that you start to see the connections.
Definitely. Okay, so Anne comes to Scotland. She is now in Scotland. They have a coronation for her as well, correct?
Yes, they do. Yes, she was crowned in her own right, or rather crowned separately. James had already been crowned as a baby. And at that coronation, she really took her place as Queen of Scots, not Queen Regnant or anything, but Queen Consort. And the ceremony made it very clear that everything she held in right of James, and she held it at his grace and favour, really, which is what he wanted.
How did she adapt to Scotland?
I've wondered because she seemed to take to it fairly easily, but it must have been. I mean, she'd come from this loving family. She went to Scotland. I mean, this was expected of royal women and things to be carted off and married off and all of this. But immediately there were factions forming. There was infighting amongst nobles. I mean, this had started even during James's Scandinavian trip. His retinue of gentlemen were constantly fighting each other for precedence and stuff. So I do think, and she was young, she was 15, I mean, a 15-year-old
Oh,
girl. And you know, God, that must have been scary. But one of the things I think is so fascinating about Anne is almost immediately she rolled up her sleeves and started fighting herself, started fighting for her property rights, started arguing. When James tried to inflict a master of her household on her, she threw a bit of a tantrum, said, "No, I rule my household, I choose my people." So she came ready to fight.
So she was raised to be a queen.
Yes, her mother, Sophia or Sophia, really seemed to have had, since again, crazy, taught to be a queen. I think taught her how to not rule because that wasn't her job, but to rule those areas in which she did have rights, and she did have the right over her household. The Scottish consort traditionally had the right to choose their household, choose their people. So Anna seemed right from the beginning to know her rights and to be very sensitive to any infringement on her rights.
Did she bring any Danish traditions to Scotland that maybe were new?
One of them was decorum. And we know this because James had run a very kind of, we'd call it a laddish court now. It was very, all about muddy hunting boots and all this sort of stuff. And etiquette had kind of fallen, or rather, deference had fallen. One of the traditions of Scottish monarchy really was that they ran it in the French style, in which almost anyone of certain rank had, for example, access to the royal bedchamber, could go in and out at will, really. So there were, I think from Anna's perspective, there was a lack of decorum. And we know that she tried very hard to stamp a measure of decorum on this raucous Scottish court because the courtiers started complaining about it, saying things like, "Things have strangely altered since the Queen came." So she was definitely trying to, I guess, tidy up the Scottish court to make it a more kind of not more deferential, but more etiquette-driven space, I think.
Was that well received?
It probably it was well received by people that hadn't been getting the kind of free access to James, because if things were more formal, there were formal channels by which you could access the king, whereas James had a long history of really just having favourites, playing favourites with people. And if you were in his charmed inner circle, you would get anything you wanted. And James, this was a kind of thing with James until the end of his life. If he liked you, he really liked you, and he would give you anything you wanted. But that obviously annoyed a lot of people who weren't in the inner circle. So Anna coming provided another kind of route to patronage.
Often in, let's say, historical fiction or film, it's portrayed that James and Anne did not have a very good relationship. Is that the
Oh, I
truth?
know. No. And I feel like it's one of those things that just irritates me, because you're absolutely right, Rebecca. It's always portrayed, even in non-fiction. I've come across a great deal of non-fiction, particularly older non-fiction, I should point out, but older books, biographies that will say things like, "Well, James was a very educated man, and Anna wasn't particularly educated in terms of academia. So they must have, they had nothing in common. He wasn't interested in her." They very quickly, their relationship soured. I think that's not how it worked. James, I think, like any other early modern king, was an autocrat. I mean, he wanted to rule, he wanted to be in charge. The last thing he wanted was, a bit like Henry VIII, he didn't want his wife arguing with him over doctrine or over sort of esoteric religious or academic points. So he didn't want an educated wife, at least in terms of academic education. What he wanted, and which Anna wasn't, was an extremely compliant wife. He wanted a very submissive wife, and Anna was not very submissive. Anna, as I mentioned, would stand up for what she knew to be her rights. So that did lead to the occasional arguments, particularly when Prince Henry was born in the mid 1590s, and there were questions over custody, but they didn't lead the kind of life by which they could have separate lives or be apart. In fact, even whilst all the arguments were going on about who should raise Prince Henry, I mean, they were still firing out children almost every year. So these people were clearly living together, and clearly living together quite happily, actively. So yeah, I think it's become this myth that they kind of they had no interests that they shared, and they had no sort of common personality, and they lived apart. It's just not true. No. In fact, as the years went on, it became incredibly clear that they had a really strong affection for one another.
Yes, but as you mentioned previously, there was some differences in religion between them.
Yes, and this is particularly during James's time in Scotland, but during both their time in Scotland. So there is a strong tradition, a strong scholarly tradition, of identifying Anna as having converted to Catholicism. And this is often presented as something that embarrassed James, something that, you know, James, his kind of reckless wife fell in with the Catholics, and he was mortified by this. I have a slightly different reading, and I don't think she converted to Catholicism. Why do I think that? Well, I should put the case for it first of all. The case for Anna converting to Catholicism is that several priests claimed to have performed the conversion. Several Jesuit priests actually came forward later on and said, "Oh yeah, I converted the Queen of Scots," and they would give a date for it. But that raises red flag. After, I hate to use the phrase red flags, everyone uses it, but it raises red flags to me. I'm speaking as someone that was raised Catholic. I don't think you need to be converted more than once. I think once it's done, it's done. So some of these priests were clearly lying, or Anna was playing games with them. The other issues after, I know this is jumping ahead a bit, but after they gained the throne in England, the Pope wrote to one of his spies who was supposedly smuggling things, Catholic things for Anna. And this spy had written almost in exasperation saying, well, she goes to Anglican masses, Anglican services, Protestant services quite often. I'm not really sure what's going on here. And the Pope wrote back saying, we have no good knowledge of this queen. So I thought, if the Pope didn't know that she had converted, she probably didn't convert. But this does still leave the question of, well, what was going on? My theory is that she and James were working together. Both of them in the 1590s were writing to the Pope in very respectful tones, calling themselves obedient children, calling him the Holy Father. I think that both of them were engaged in a ploy to impress the Pope, to let the Pope and Catholics think that they were either in the process of conversion, willing to convert, or at least friendly and sympathetic towards Catholicism. And the reason I think they were doing it is because they both had a joint goal, and that was to gain the English throne after Elizabeth's death. And what they did not want, James or Anna, and I think we need to look at them as being in this together. They were King and Queen of Scots. They had the same kind of code of honour. And what they didn't want was continental Catholic objection to the Stuart succession. And they didn't want English Catholics to stand up to them, to refuse them. They wanted Catholics to accept them as the next King and Queen of England. So I think that they were both playing games, essentially. I think that they were both posing as Catholics, and she did it better. Because this sounds very cynical. I think she was genuinely sympathetic to Catholics. She certainly had a lot of Catholic friends, but I don't think she went as far as conversion. And I certainly don't think that this was something that embarrassed James. I think he knew absolutely what she was up to. He knew that she was friendly with Catholics. He thought he could use it to political advantage.
So there's absolutely no truth that she was involved in the gunpowder plot or wanted to put her daughter on the throne?
Not even a scrap. Less than a scrap. I know I've read, I know the article you're talking about, and it's fun and it's kind of an interesting what if, but no, it's not even based on a contemporary rumor. So it's absolutely not true. One of the things Anna held in huge esteem was the role of the monarch and the position of monarchy. I think the idea of killing a king would have horrified her, not just her husband, aside from the fact I think she genuinely quite liked her husband and her son, definitely. She would never have countenanced any subject killing the monarch. It would have been absolutely alien to her.
Just the idea that you say she liked her husband just changes such a narrative about them that I think the most common perception is that she despised her husband because of his male companionship. Is there anything to show that?
No. Well, to kind of tell the story in order, in the 1590s, when they were in Scotland as a married couple, when they were producing children, there were no reports of him taking male lovers. There was, interestingly, a report where she got annoyed when he had supposedly taken a female lover, Fair Mistress Murray, Anne Murray. And we know very little about her. We have a surviving poem James wrote supposedly to her, but how long the affair lasted, what the precise nature of it was, is slightly sort of unclear. But Anna seemed to be annoyed at this, and there was some sort of infighting around the time of Mistress Murray's wedding, which Anna refused to attend. So there clearly was a bit of tension there. But there were no reports of male lovers coming back into the picture until they got to England. And then James's, he certainly had a romantic preference for men. He used the language of love with men more than women. But during his time in Scotland and during his marriage in Scotland, he seems to have been faithful to Anna. Apart from that one woman, she's muddy.
And part of me feels like I could relate with her a little bit. Not that this has happened in my own life, but I could understand how maybe it was harder for her to see her husband with another woman versus with a man.
Yes, that may have been the case. Although when they gained the English throne and when they were in England, as I said, James started, we start to get reports then of James kissing men and letting them kiss him publicly and things like this. But again, Anna does not seem to have cared at all. No reports of her minding this particularly. And there are still lots of affectionate letters between husband and wife until 1607. Now, two things happened. Anne had her last child. She had a daughter, Sophia, who sadly died within a few days of birth. But after that, there were no more children and no more pregnancies. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the next year, 1607, so that was in 1606, in 1607, James falls in love. And this time, it's not just reports of him sort of kissing, publicly kissing men or anything like that. This time, it is he fell in love. And this was with Robert Carr, who was a not particularly intelligent or likeable young Scot. James saw him at the accession day tilts, and supposedly he either fell or was thrown from his horse, and some reports say he broke a leg, some an arm, and James stood up, looked down, and for some reason was smitten with this guy, just was smitten with him. And from that point on, I think in the book about James, I parallel this with Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, because it wasn't a case of a kind of immediate overnight thing. This went on for, again, about 7 years for him to reach his height, Robert Carr. But James really did seem to adore this guy. He was in his curious mix of love and affection and a desire to be really paternalistic. He was trying to teach him Latin, and he was trying to educate him and trying to make him a statesman, but also showering him in kisses and love and all of this sort of stuff. So James had a really strong patriarchal streak, but Anna did not like Robert Carr. Now, this was not because necessarily she was jealous. It was because Robert Carr was an idiot. And the reason he was an idiot was he thought that he did not have to defer to the Queen in any way. There are reports of him laughing at her publicly, treating her with disrespect. Now, Anna seems to have been quite happy for her husband in their later years for him to take on these male lovers, provided the male lovers treated her as queen and deferred to her as queen. Robert Carr did not do that. He was laughing at her. He was just generally being a nuisance and being greedy and ambitious and unpleasant. And she was furious. She hated him. And she made no secret of hating him. James was not happy about this because, again, James's desire to have this family unit, as odd as this sounds, resurfaced. What he wanted was his lover and his wife and his children all to form one big sort of happy family together. And that couldn't happen with Robert Carr.
How very modern.
Yes, isn't it? Yes. Yeah. I think that's one of the things I just really find fascinating about James. You've got this stuff that is just so modern seeming and so kind of relevant today, alongside the divine right of kings and the witchcraft attitudes. So you've got these really archaic seeming attitudes, and then you've got these really sort of liberal permissive ones. Now, I should say, on the subject of his sexuality, because I know that the Mary and George series is coming out with you next month, I think.
Okay.
It's good. It's good. But it's not very accurate. But it's just a good watch with some fantastic acting. But James wrote specifically that he was very much against the vice, as he called it, of sodomy, as he called it. And that has led people to think, well, maybe whatever he was doing with these male lovers wasn't that, you know, maybe it was something else. But again, we have to put that against, well, he also wrote against swearing, and he did that a lot. He also wrote about the importance of good economy, and he certainly wasn't doing that. So it's very difficult, I think, to take someone writing publicly against something as evidence that they weren't doing it.
Right. It's a case of do as I say, not as I do.
Exactly. I think James was the master of do as I say, not as I do.
Okay. So I do want to touch base a little bit on their family unit. You know, what type of involvement did Anna have in their children's education or their upbringing?
Not as much as she would like when it came to the heir to the throne, Prince Henry. She really wanted custody of Prince Henry. And again, older biographies and things usually present this as silly women, you know, just going mad with maternal instincts and not being politically savvy. And I disagree. And the reason I disagree is, well, it certainly wasn't just unchecked maternal desire, because she raised no objection to her other children being given to noble families. There was clearly something about Prince Henry. What could it have been? Well, he was the heir to the throne. She knew that if James was assassinated or fell off his horse in one of his endless hunting trips and died, whoever held the prince held kind of keys to the kingdom. And she also, I think, had a bit of an issue because previous consorts of Scotland, so Mary Queen of Scots' mother, for example, Mary of Guise, they had been given Stirling Castle as part of their dower properties. And she wasn't. And that's where Prince Henry was being raised by the Earl of Mar. So I think she saw, I'm being denied my rights here. I'm going to kick up a fuss about it. So I think that's what she was really interested in Henry for, was she loved him. I mean, she really loved her children. She was a deeply loving mother, but she also saw the political value in them. And we see this later when Prince Henry is alive in England. He obviously died young, but We see them almost combining to stand up against Robert Carr, for example. They will sponsor political appointments to get one over Robert Carr when he's at the king's right hand.
Interesting. So how many children did they have together that survived?
Let me, oh, that survived, only three of them, sadly. So, well, only three of them survived infancy. So Prince Henry survived infancy, but still died at 18, sadly. Prince Charles survived infancy, although he didn't survive his own reign, as we know, as Charles the First. And Princess Elizabeth, who is, I believe, the king, almost the Stuart who the current royal line passed through.
Okay. You mentioned Charles, and I don't know why it is. I always forget that Charles the First was the child of James and Anna.
Oh yes. Yes, Charles is an interesting one. Charles is a figure that frustrates me in a lot of ways, and yet I kind of have sympathy for, because like James, you can see his childhood. He inherited from his mother, from Anna, an incredible fondness and skill in the arts. I mean, he was interested in artistic pursuits, in visual arts, in theatre. He was good at this sort of thing. And so had Anna been. Anna, when she was Queen Consort in England, was probably the biggest cultural patron as Queen that England has ever seen. Charles got that from her. What he got from his father was, unfortunately, a belief in the divine right of kings and a hatred of parliament.
And that was the beginning of his end,
It
right?
was indeed. James, for all his faults, James, I think, clashed with Parliament, but knew when to back down and knew when to negotiate. And yes, he certainly knew when to be imperious and to give the full sort of almost Tudor high-handedness, but he knew when to back away. Charles, I think, he was unfortunate in that he met a Parliament that was just as stiff-necked as he was. So the people, the men of Parliament in the Caroline era were just as unwilling to back down as the king was. Poor
So,
Charles.
well, and then their daughter Elizabeth became Queen of Bohemia.
Yes, she did. The Winter Queen was her a very charming sounding nickname, but it was originally a kind of dig at her husband that he had only managed to be King of Bohemia for a winter before being
That's right.
chased out. And that led to the big final crisis of James's reign. Obviously, it's the outbreak of the 30 Years' War, this crisis in Bohemia, and then as it spread all over the continent.
Okay, so in 1603, Queen Elizabeth the First dies.
Yes,
James
James must
is.
have been delighted. Yes, James was delighted. Such an interesting relationship. When I was writing the biography on James, I loved writing James and Elizabeth. I just loved the letters going back and forth. The you can almost feel the resentment between them, and they were kind of locked in this alliance because they were both Protestants, they were both monarchs of British kingdoms, but you can just tell they distrusted one another. He was constantly badgering her, demanding that she acknowledge his right to the succession. She was constantly paying off mischief makers to go and cause trouble in Scotland. Just this sort of weird dance that they were locked in. Because I remember thinking, oh God, this is going to run out of steam when Elizabeth dies. I hope it didn't. I hope it was still interesting after.
It makes you wonder if he felt some resentment towards Elizabeth for his mother's death, or how she felt towards him because of who his mother was.
Yes, I think that is a big question, because in 1599, for example, a very curious thing happened. James stood up in Parliament and accused Elizabeth of threatening to dig up his mother or disinter her from Peterborough and burn her body. Now, why he came out with this, I don't know. He was goading her. He was, and they did this to each other constantly. And she flew into a rage and threatened to cut off the pension she'd agreed to pay him before Mary Queen of Scots had been executed. And there were constant moments like this. There were constant moments of him saying inflammatory things or her saying inflammatory things against each other, and then both sort of refusing to speak to each other or swap letters for a brief period, and then making up again. And it was just so bizarre. Such a bizarre relationship.
It is. Now, I'm wondering, did James and Anna enjoy England? Did they like living in England, or did they prefer Scotland?
Oh, they preferred England. James, with Anna, I don't think Anna had a preference. I think she enjoyed the artistic pursuits in England far, far more than Scotland, because there, in England, obviously, the Renaissance was in full swing. She was able to pay and work with men like Ben Jonson, geniuses, writers, and she took full advantage of it. She was able to take to the stage. Both of them preferred England for a very clear reason, and it was a religious reason. It wasn't that they were so Catholic, Protestant, that aside, why they preferred England was because in England, the monarch was the supreme head of the church. In Scotland, the Presbyterian Kirk was very much of the mind, the monarch is just another member. The monarch is not in charge and should not be in charge. What you find in Scotland, what dogged them both in Scotland, was these very fiery Calvinist preachers openly from pulpits saying the Queen is a devil, she dances too much, she bawls too much, the King is too soft on Catholics. So James and Anna were actually under quite a lot of threat in Scotland. They were constantly being criticised. And James, when he got to England, said, this is the promised land. He called England the promised land. Why? Because this is what he dreamed of. The ministers weren't allowed to preach against him from pulpits. They weren't allowed to criticise him. He thought, this was great. This is wonderful. This is what I dreamed kingship was like. I'm not being criticised anymore.
Was there a lot of pushback in Scotland from the Scottish subjects once they were living in England? Were they upset about how much he liked it there or his views?
Surprisingly not. Not that I've come across. And James certainly boasted that when he got to England, he said, here I sit and govern Scotland by the pen, which others could not do with the sword. So he had managed in England to create a system whereby it could sort of survive an absentee monarch. It could sort of not break out into rebellion or anything like that. There were some riots and there was some trouble in the days and weeks when he first went to England. As soon as he heard that he was King of England, he was gone. I mean, he couldn't get out of Scotland fast enough. He was gone within 2 weeks.
Like a trail of dust behind him.
Exactly. He left his wife and kids as well. They had to follow later. But no, there wasn't a huge sort of public outcry or anything like that. And he did promise to return every 3 years, which he didn't. He came back once. He came back once in 1617. And then it was to try and force through his English-flavoured religious sort of views and practices on Scots. And they balked at that. They weren't too happy about that.
Oh my gosh, I've had so much fun chatting with you about this today. I definitely know now I need to have you back again to focus more on specific subjects that we've covered.
But oh yes.
There's so much.
Well, I was thinking as well, once the Mary and George show has been on, we can talk about maybe what it got wrong and what it got right. The real, because we never got on to George Villiers, actually. Robert Carr, that great favourite, that sort of the Anne Boleyn to James, he met a not as sticky a fate as poor Anne, but he also had a downfall, and it was that downfall that allowed the famous George Villiers to step into centre stage and become Duke of Buckingham.
We'll leave that for our next interview. Yeah. What I want to end with today is I would love for you to maybe tell me what your favorite thing is about James and what your favorite thing is about Anna.
Oh, I think my favorite thing about James is that he had a pet armadillo that had its own keeper. its
What?
own a pet armadillo with its a royal armadillo keeper. So that is when you know you've really hit the sort of height of lavish excess when you have a pet armadillo and its own keeper. My favorite thing about Anna, I think, is when James was in the throes of his passion with Robert Carr, she had staged a mask which really extolled the virtues of queenship and the power of queens with herself in it. And I thought, God, that was her kind of smack down, her slap in the face to this upstart Robert Carr that was monopolizing the king's attention. She publicly reasserted the power of queens.
I love that so much. She sounds like such an amazing queen, and I'm so happy that you were able to join me today to discuss this royal couple and some of the history.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's fascinating. And I have to say, one thing about the series is it's probably the only time I've ever actually seen Anna in a drama series. I mean, which is crazy. She was one of the most interesting queen consorts of England. And yet I had never ever seen her as a in a speaking role in a drama series. And the actress is very good. She's brilliant. She really sort of shows the intelligence behind her.
Wonderful. And I'll look for the information on when it's going to be released here in the US and share that with my listeners as well. And we'll have Stephen back to discuss some of the inaccuracies on that program
Oh,
after it's
thank
been
you.
aired.
I'll look forward to
Stephen, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks a lot, Rebecca. Thank you again.
The Tudors Dynasty Podcast.